Welcome to This Is America, October 27th, 2024. On this episode, we feature an interview with an organizer at Rural Organizing and Resilience, or ROAR, and two collective members of Firestorm Books. Both are located in Western North Carolina. We speak to them about organizing autonomous mutual aid relief efforts in the wake of the recent hurricanes. We then talk to two hosts of the new anarchist podcast, The Dugout, and finally discuss the unfolding election. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. Resistance and solidarity with Palestine and against the continued war and genocide in Gaza continues as mass protests, student walkouts, building occupations, indirect actions continue across the world. In Montreal on September 30th, as Clash MTL reported, a militant march hit the streets, breaking windows in a luxury shopping district and fighting with police with fireworks and Molotov cocktails. As one report noted, militants targeted Concordia University because of their refusal to divest from genocide and police brutality unleashed against students. In early October, hundreds of students at Pomona University in Southern California walked out in protest of the ongoing war and genocide happening in Gaza, taking over Carnegie Hall for several hours. The occupation and walkout is just the latest mass demonstration organized by students who this spring voted in a campus referendum for the university to disclose and divest from Israel. After the university refused, in April, students stormed and occupied the office of the president, leading to around 20 arrests. In the Bay Area, protesters blocked entrances to a Lockheed Martin research facility. At Harvard, students organized a study-in in solidarity with Palestine. At UCLA, a demonstration organized by Jewish students in solidarity with Palestine was broken up by police and one person was arrested. And at the University of Minnesota, students in late October occupied a hall on the university campus. You can read a statement on the occupation linked in our show notes. In repression news, a heavily armed group of riot police raided the residential home of students in Philadelphia under the pretext of investigating minor pro-Palestinian vandalism that had taken place on the Penn State campus. No one was charged, no arrests were made. For more information, check out the report in The Intercept linked in our show notes. In tenant news in Montreal, according to a report from the Anti-Eviction Brigade, yesterday morning, a precarious tenant in fragile health was to be evicted by a bailiff following shenanigans by her landlord. In response, more than 30 comrades associated with the brigade and from various anti-capitalist backgrounds through their organizations came to oppose the eviction and show their support for the tenant. Check out the full report linked in our show notes. Autonomous activists in Montreal also took over a building for a community gathering of workshops and other radical events. The Montreal Autonomous Tenant Union has also been busy organizing pickets demanding a rent freeze at one location. In Boston, Massachusetts, the local tenant union organized a block party. In Sacramento, California, the Sac Valley Tenants Union also took part in a rally at an apartment complex organized by tenants to demand repairs following a fire. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, locals of the Los Angeles Tenant Union, or LATU, organized two back-to-back protests against gentrifying real estate companies that have been harassing elderly tenants in Highland and Echo Park. Service workers continued to organize and join the Anti-Capitalist Labor Union, the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW. In Portland, Oregon, workers at a Pete's Coffee location have now joined the union, joining workers in the Bay Area at several stores who have been organizing and holding demonstrations. Last week in Oakland, California, IWW members held an in-store protest supporting a fellow worker in a disciplinary hearing. Back in Portland, service workers at the Fried Egg have also been fighting and holding pickets against the targeting of IWW organizers. Autonomous disaster relief efforts continue across Appalachia and in the south in the wake of devastating hurricanes following Helene and Milton. A recent Palestine to Appalachia caravan was organized, bringing much-needed supplies to impacted areas. Various mutual aid disaster hubs have also been organized across the south and Appalachia. Check out continuous updates for mutual aid disaster relief and Triangle Mutual Aid linked in our show notes. Also, several Cop City protesters who faced years in prison for taking part in a demonstration at a university in Georgia had their charges dropped. According to the Atlanta Solidarity Fund, newly released video from the police body cam of the arrest shows, quote, Atlanta police higher-ups conspiring to fabricate felony charges against protesters because they were part of a group which opposed Cop City. In the video, GSU police say they had no basis for felony charges for eight people who protested at a construction site. An APD major pressures officers to come up with anything to charge them with to help APD crack down on, quote, this group, meaning the Stop Cop City movement. The protesters then charged with felony burglary, jailed for almost a week, and fought the case for 2 years. The prosecutor dropped all charges days before the trial. It could not be more clear. APD is manipulating the criminal legal system to silence its critics. See the footage linked in our show notes. And now for some upcoming events. From November 1st through the 3rd is the Chicago Anarchist Skillshare in Chicago, Illinois. On November 9th is a benefit for Food Not Bombs in Bremerton, Washington. From November 26th through the 28th is the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence happening in so-called Phoenix, Arizona. On December 7th is the San Antonio Anarchist Book Fair in San Antonio, Texas. And from February 28th through March 2nd is the Florida Abolitionist Gathering happening in Gainesville, Florida. That's going to do it for us. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussion, and we will see you soon.
Hey, my name is Matt. I'm with a group called Rural Organizing Resilience, or ROAR. We're based out here in Madison County, which is a small rural county of about 20,000 people. It's northwest of Asheville. Our organization formed back in winter of 2017 in response to the growing white supremacist organizing in the region, kind of post-Trump election. And we continue to do anti-racist work, but we've also taken on a lot of mutual aid efforts in these past several years. And so we've just dove right into the hurricane response.
Hi, my name's Liberty. I'm a member of the Firestorm Collective. We are a queer feminist collective here in Asheville, in southern Appalachia, on Cherokee land. And we've been around for about 16 years, principally as a group organizing and running a anarchist bookstore. But we managed to get ourselves into lots of other stuff as well.
And I'm Beck, also a member of the Firestorm Collective. In, I guess, normal times, I'm our buyer and sort of like spreadsheet and systems guy. And so I have found myself plugging in to sort of infrastructural and communication efforts on the ground in sort of coordination with mutual aid disaster relief.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I know there's a lot going on. So I just want to start this conversation by getting your initial thoughts about everything that's happening. What are y'all thinking right now?
Yeah, I think we're in a little bit of a transitional moment. Kind of the immediacy of addressing survival needs in our neighborhood and our region was kind of our primary focus for the first 2 weeks after the storm. And as resources have arrived, both, you know, an increase in grassroots resources, but also NGO and, you know, federal and state resources, we've started to shift our focus a bit, but are still finding our footing in this new reality. And I think a thing that all of us are grappling with right now is the fact that the immediate survival needs presented in the aftermath of the storm was really only the beginning, and that we're now looking at a real devastation of our community that's extremely long-term, not only devastation of the geography, but the likelihood of mass displacement, increased economic precarity, and a lot of inequality in recovery We're looking at, you know, a resumption of evictions, toxicity in public housing, and all kinds of other really kind of terrifying realities that we're now figuring out how to navigate moving forward.
Yeah, I'd say likewise. You know, we're kind of getting out of that immediate crisis mode. Well, and though we are still meeting kind of emergency needs here and there, yeah, there's still houses without power. There's still, and there's so many people just without houses right now. They're like living in tents and it's getting cold. But I think, yeah, we're just trying to like wrap our heads around like just how widespread the destruction and the long lasting impacts are. You know, it's like hit 21 counties in Western North Carolina, also hit Eastern Tennessee, upstate, South Carolina, North Georgia. And you know, on top of all the houses and lives that were lost, there's like so many people, like probably tens of thousands of people that are just like without jobs right now. And just the long-term impacts of that, is just, it's hard to even know where to start in like meeting those needs.
Like when you heard this was coming, like what did it look like on the ground in terms of evacuations? What was the state's response to that? Just like how did this start to play out?
You know, this is not the first time we've had flooding from a hurricane come through the area. A few years ago, there were some pretty bad floods in Canton area from a hurricane. And notably in 2004, there was pretty major flooding from another two hurricanes that hit us. But this one was just beyond anything that one could compare to. I think really, no matter how prepared anyone was, we were all caught unprepared just because the event was so unprecedented. So I can't remember the dates exactly, but I think the storm and flooding hit like around September 27th or so. And, you know, the way it played out for me was, and, you know, my friends was, we were seeing on social media that flooding was starting in Marshall, which is the town closest to me. That town was already starting to flood before the hurricane even hit here because we had another storm that had dumped lots of rain. And, you know, high winds, flooding started happening, and eventually power went out. But even after the power went out, we still had communications for a little while. So I think, you know, we were in touch with each other, but then all of a sudden cell phones went down, the internet went down, and no one had the ability to communicate with anyone in the, like, entire Western North Carolina. So that was, like, really the scary point. You know, myself, you know, the last text I got from my parents was a small creek near their house was this huge river all of a sudden, you know, flooding their bridge. And then I just couldn't communicate with them after that. And that was, like, what happened for a lot of people. And so really it was just, like, 24 to 48 hours of people not really knowing what was going on, like, just how widespread that this devastation was, because we could only know it was before our own eyes. So it really took a couple of days for people to be able to, like, connect with each other and start making a game plan of, like, how to respond, even knowing what we were responding to.
How it played out, you know, how I just remember things playing out at Firestorm. Right, so Thursday, like the Thursday of the storm, I think that was like the 25th or the 26th of September. And yeah, before the hurricane even hit, you know, our collective mates, who, you know, didn't live immediately in West Asheville, like weren't able to come in because the flooding, you know, was already, happening, in like southeast Asheville. And so I remember us like coming in on Thursday and running the store and then closing down at 5. And like, I think, yeah, we like, I remember referring to it as like, we have there's a weather event, happening and, you know, all the usual things like, you know, folks on, you know, runs on the grocery stores and milk and bread and gas and all the things. But, I don't. Yeah, I definitely, certainly none of us at Firestorm expected what we got. And yeah, then I would just echo a lot of the things that Matt said about those like first moments or those first, you know, Friday morning. And I think like Right. The other thing, Firestorm was not in an area that was directly impacted by flooding. But I think one of the wildest experiences on Friday morning, as the storm was hitting, was just hearing just the like cracks and booms of just trees just falling all around.
Tree after tree after tree going down.
Yeah. And so we didn't get the flooding, but, just widespread devastation to infrastructure, power and cell and internet.
And it's worth noting that Asheville just has bad infrastructure. And so in some ways, it's sort of par for the course. You know, a storm hits, you can basically assume that there's going to be a boil water advisory. You know, the electricity is going to go out. There's a real failure to invest in infrastructure in our region and in our city. So I think initially we were responding to an assumption that there would be a short-term disruption of infrastructure. And it really didn't become apparent, like Matt said, for probably a day or two, that this was actually way beyond anything that we had anticipated. And I think the moment where it really hit me the hardest was, there was no internet. Pretty much the radio was the only way to get good information initially. And I remember on Friday turning on the radio and hearing that all major roads in and out of Asheville were blocked. And having this bizarre, almost cinematic experience of being we're living in a situation in which there is no help immediately coming because the highways are closed. And I think that was a real wake up call.
Yeah. And they were announcing that on our local NPR affiliate, which they couldn't keep on the air. A lot of times we were turning on the radio and it was just dead air.
Yeah, I'll also add on top of all the, all major roads coming to the region were closed, and then there's an endless number of roads just throughout these rural counties that are just gone, they're just washed away. So, just traveling was a crapshoot, whether you could get from point A to point B where you never really expect to go. And on top of that, because the power was out, you couldn't get gasoline. So if you hadn't topped off on your, topped off your gas tank before the storm, you're pretty limited in what you could do. And again, that especially impacted rural areas, especially for us, just doing one wellness check could take a half tank of gas. So that really hugely limited what we were able to do in the first few days. And I think just added to that general fear and helplessness at first. And also just want to I know people have seen the pictures and stuff probably, but just really emphasize how intense and widespread the damage is. My county, Madison County, we had, I consider our county lucky in that we only had two towns flood, and that was the worst that happened. Going over to Yancey and Mitchell County, every single creek in that county is a disaster zone because those creeks became rivers and washed away homes and took lives. It's just hard to even fathom.
Talk a little bit about just the extent of the devastation, because I feel like most people here listening to this have obviously been through a storm, probably lived through an instance where the power goes out or been impacted by something maybe a little bit like this, but I feel like the images that we saw of, just rivers washing buildings away, is hard for people to wrap their heads around.
There are several towns that are just gone. Every building in their downtown is gone. My town of Marshall, one quarter of the town is gone. The rest is flooded out. In the town of Hot Springs, which is another town in our county, every single building that was downtown had catastrophic flooding. It's just so again, just so people understand, in the hardest hit areas, 30 inches of rain fell in 48 hours, and it's different here in the mountains in that, like, that rain doesn't kind of where it's spread out, so it just becomes these raging rivers. And, you know, it just washed away entire buildings. I saw, like, this huge oil tank that was probably, like, I don't know, 50 feet tall by, like, 80 feet wide that was just, like, upended and, like, lodged into a bridge. And, you know, it's wiped out roads. It's wiped out railroads. It's wiped out, you know, power poles. You know, there's still, I think there's still communities that won't have power until December, probably, because the power company, there's not even roads for the power company to get to the communities to restore power. And, like, the power company is actually, like, starting to, like, cut new paths for transmission lines to get into communities in alternate routes because they just can't get in the way they used to be able to. And even there's not even the land to build, like, to put power poles into now because it's just a riverbed. And again, this is across, like, an area that's, you know, 21 counties in Western North Carolina alone. I don't know if y'all have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the violence of flash flooding cannot be overstated. Like, when we say flooding, we don't mean, like, waters rose up and then receded. Like we mean, like, water, like, crashing down a mountain and, you know, collecting debris. I mean, you know, large, like shipping containers. And, you know, those are just wiping out, you know, bridges and infrastructure.
We're talking about 26 feet of rise in some places where above the normal levels for creeks and rivers. Yeah. I mean, you're just huge. Like, even, you know, here in Asheville, you can see places where the asphalt roads were torn to pieces by the floodwaters.
Yeah, the dog park where we walk our dogs, there's, you know,
there's nothing there anymore.
Well, trees except for, like, an RV that is, like, wrapped around, like, a wooden, like, staircase and a random shipping container, like, sitting, you know, in what was, like, a walking path. So, yeah, I think just, like, being clear that when we say flooding, like, it wasn't just that, like, everything got wet. Just a really...
Very extremely violent.
Yeah.
I know famously there was a note that was posted on Firestorm.
Famously.
Yeah, that was posted on Firestorm saying that there was going to be a community meeting. But also, like, in terms of outside Asheville, you know, what was that like? How did that come together? So just talk about how that response started to percolate.
Well, I think it's probably worth naming that the response started before the storm arrived. I mean, people were organizing. They were not organizing based on an understanding of the scale of devastation, but they were already organizing because I think we already have pretty good infrastructure in place and history with flooding. And so there were already, like, signal loops and things that had been created to coordinate relief efforts before the storm arrived. Of course, we didn't know that none of us were going to be able to use signal for the next, like, week. you know, the effort started immediately. And you referenced the anonymous note that somebody put on the door of our info shop, calling for a community meeting. And I guess the story there is that when we arrived on Friday after we were able to, like, leave our homes, we found this sign on Firestorm's door that we had not put there, calling for a community meeting share resources and information and figure out how to take care of each other, which we thought was really beautiful and exactly what we want as anarchists, to see that kind of spontaneous self-organization and be able to provide infrastructure and, like, a known location for people to gather and begin doing that work.
Yeah, I think for Roar, you know, as soon as we were able to kind of actually make contact over phone with each other. We quickly organized the meeting. It was probably that Sunday night that we had our first meeting. And then we're able to quickly pull together a mutual aid hub within a day or two of that meeting. Yeah, thanks to our friends at Holler Harm Reduction that also operate in Madison County, we were able to secure a space for a mutual aid hub. And we quickly put out the call for supplies. And right off the bat, we also already had, we were actually in better shape out in Madison County with the water situation because a lot of us, our houses are on springs, so it doesn't require, municipal infrastructure. So we were able to go ahead and start filling up containers and getting those to places in need and, you know, bringing them to Asheville and such. And we put the word out to bring supplies in from outside to our friends like out in the Raleigh-Durham area and Atlanta and such. And those started coming in. And another huge thing that was super important in the initial days was just doing wellness checks. We were getting flooded. It was pretty heartbreaking. Yeah, just flooded with these requests from people's family members from all over the country saying they hadn't heard from their son, their daughter, their uncle, their grandpa, whatever. And so they would send us, the name and an address, or sometimes not even an address. So they just live up this holler. Can you go look for them? And so we were doing a lot of that. And that also like helped put us in contact with communities with acute needs. So for example, I one of the first days went out to do a wellness check on for someone's son, just to see if they're still alive, still okay. And, get down to around where the address is and couldn't drive any further because the road's just gone. And then I was able to, link up with some neighbors that had maybe seen this person, and they showed me a path through the woods. So I walked like 15 minutes to go check on this person, and thankfully they were alive and well. But then also made contact with another house that had two elderly people on oxygen that were having to hike in their oxygen tanks in and out. So we were able to like get them help with that. And I would just say, like, imagine that scenario unfolding over like, several hundred square miles, and like just there, so many valleys and hollers where it's just inaccessible, and the only way to get in was on foot or four-wheeler or by air.
Community members and activists, I think, really did an enormous amount of rapid response in the early days of this. It was days before the city really managed to do anything at all. FEMA didn't arrive for a shocking amount of time, considering the fact that it's their prerogative to be on the ground before storms hit. And in that space, I think just an incredible amount of life-saving work was being done by folks who woke up one morning completely unprepared for this and threw themselves into caring for their neighbors and taking care of friends and family. And in fact, in some cases, there was a lot of spontaneous self-organization that kind of emerged based on organic need. There were also things like, the city set up a line to call for, folks who were missing or needed wellness checks, but seemingly didn't have the resources to actually conduct those checks, probably because the cops were guarding the grocery stores. We definitely heard early on that the police department chose to focus its resources on preventing looting rather than doing wellness checks. But hilariously, the work of actually doing wellness checks in Asheville, which was conducted out of the Register of Deeds office, was largely done by anarchists and activists who mobilized in large numbers around the Register of Deeds office to work through the list that the city had collected to actually do the like on the ground work in those early days.
I'd add another big thing that we helped organize with, and also just like self-organized all across the region, was sending out chainsaw crews to help clear roads and driveways. Cause, so many people, even if the road wasn't washed away, there were just like unbelievable number of trees down across roads and driveways. So that also was making, communities inaccessible. So that was a huge thing. And also I really want to emphasize that it wasn't just like, you know, the activist scene doing that. That's something just like rural people do too. It's like they, you know, as soon as a disaster hits, they're out, you know, just the community is out there with their chainsaws, getting roads cleared, and out there with like heavy equipment, bulldozing new roads where need be and trying to patch up stuff where they can.
How much of the response is sort of the connections already built?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Like, we were able to be so effective because of the work we've done in our community for years. And, you know, even beyond, stretching back beyond the formation of Roar, many of us have lived here for over 20, 25 years. Some of us are, you know, born and raised here. So absolutely, is you know, the connections we have. You know, for example, we have a working relationship with Firestorm already, so it's very easy to like start coordinating supplies between the two of our groups. And I think, you know, even stretching back to like anti-globalization days, like we have connections with friends out in the like Triangle area and other parts of the region that were, you know. You know, as soon as we got cell service back, there was like an unbelievable number of messages from outside, from, you know, people we've organized with in the past, like asking how they could help. So the networks, both formal and informal, were already in place and really invaluable and just like hitting the ground running.
Yeah, that's definitely true and was our experience. And going back to Matt's point earlier, I think it would be like difficult to overstate the degree to which mutual aid was occurring organically among people who maybe didn't know each other within the context of mutual aid, or possibly didn't know each other at all prior to the storm hitting. And we saw just an incredible number of people coming out of the woodwork and bringing the skills and resources that they had in order to kind of respond in ways that looked very anarchic. But, you know, we're not rooted in a pre-existing network.
We know that there were these meetings that happened every day in front of Firestorm. Like, what did those look like? How did those grow? And how did people start to address just these realities of living in a city where nothing works in terms of, you know, what you'd expect it to?
Yeah. I think that what's interesting is that what was happening at Firestorm was being paralleled all over Asheville. And of course, we didn't know that at the time because we couldn't communicate unless we were face-to-face with people. But I've definitely heard from other people since that all over the city, people sort of impromptu set up little, like, neighborhood assemblies and spaces to gather and regular times to meet up and strategize. And so for us, that looked like, you know, on the first day, I guess it was pretty much just people who had walked past Firestorm while they were out surveying the damage and seen the sign on the door and then come back. And maybe there were 40 to 60 people who showed up on Saturday. And then I guess word of mouth sort of spread that. And the next day there was an absolutely huge gathering of people, close to 400, which was probably the high water mark. But you know, those assemblies looked like spaces in which people could share verified information, kind of do rumor control, talk about resources. I mean, you know, it was definitely a situation where if you wanted to use the internet, you needed to find someone else who had found somewhere that they could use the internet and then have a conversation about it. So people were writing that, you know, writing tips and important information out on sheets of paper. You know, pretty quickly, those sheets of paper at Firestorm turned into an enormous community bulletin board on the exterior of the building that people could contribute to kind of day and night, or come and take photos of or write down notes from. The other thing that was happening was that people were connecting around specific areas of interest and enthusiasm.
Yeah, so because I think that at least here in like West Asheville, which aside from, you know, a lot of fallen trees, you know, did not have much flooding. I think people realized really quickly that it was water. Like it was all about the water.
Getting water to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So there were sort of multiple projects related to water that were started. I think the largest one that came out of the daily meetings at Firestorm is Be Well AVL, which had a very ambitious goal of scaling up to deliver 6,000 gallons of water a day to people in the city, with a focus on neighborhoods that were shut off from or otherwise not accessible to sites that eventually the city did set up for water distribution.
Like a week later.
Yeah, a week later.
Literally.
And that involved, organizing folks with trucks, sourcing fuel, networking with people a lot of times outside the city, like Matt mentioned, who had access to springs or wells, securing IBCs, the kind of Buffalo like water containers, getting them set up all over the city, and then running kind of constant loops to supply them for the neighborhoods. And all that work took off within a couple days of these meetings beginning.
One follow-up to that. So, you say 400 people came out to that meeting, the second one. Are these folks that are just kind of like within the circles of people that would normally come to Firestorm?
No, not at all. Yeah, no. I think what we were seeing was, people coming out of the neighborhood. Definitely a lot of people in our activist and anarchist like networks were there. And in a lot of cases were able to lend some like support, infrastructural support in terms of facilitation of that space or some project management skills, things like that, because I think anarchists have a lot of those things. But certainly the people who were showing up looking for information and looking for ways to help their neighbors were a really broad cross-section of our neighborhood.
These meetings happen. You talked about like all these different groups are forming. I know there are people doing like DIY toilets. There's people doing water distribution, going and like helping elderly folks flush toilets and stuff like that. What were some of the major problems that people ran into while they were, meeting and all this stuff was coming together? And like people like Margaret Kiljoy have done some amazing podcasts recently. We'll link to those about some of this stuff. But while these sort of like networks and nodes were being connected, like what problems did you run into that people were like, we have to address this? Like, this is happening. We need to find a way to get people out here to do X, Y, Z.
Well, I think one of the things that came up after the first few days, initially, I guess maybe just to start at the beginning, the supplies that were being distributed were just simply being redistributed from within Asheville, right? The roads were closed, so there wasn't aid coming in. So I think that first day that there was a meeting on Saturday, a lot of us literally just emptied out our freezers and pantries and brought food to put out on tables for folks. I think that day people set up grills. Folks from our neighborhood set up grills and served 600 cheeseburgers that were donated by a local restaurant that had to empty their freezers because there was no electricity. So there was just an enormous amount of finding resources locally, people digging through dumpsters, where grocery stores were beginning to like throw out things that couldn't be kept, and getting all of that out into the community. But then over the next few days, as some roads began to open, more and more supplies were coming in. Initially just neighbors with vans, folks who used to live in Asheville from, the Triangle or upstate South Carolina, and then eventually larger deliveries. And I think there were some real growing pains as supplies were coming in. We were attempting to kind of use Instagram in a lot of cases to communicate what supplies were needed. So, one day we might post, like, hey, people really need pet food. Like, we're asking that if people are able to bring supplies in, please bring dog and cat food. And then the next day we would get like this avalanche of dog and cat food from folks driving in from South Carolina, which was incredible. But there was like no off button. And we were realizing that a thing was happening where without sort of an ability to close the loop of the communication, a request would get made, and then a screenshot of the request would get circulated. And then in some cases, like a screenshot of the request would be circulated. There's no date on any of it. And it's like the cat and dog food just keep coming forever. Then individual distribution sites like Firestorm were getting sort of overwhelmed by particular supplies and needing other things. And we were realizing that there was a real kind of pooling of resources in some places while other places weren't receiving what they needed. So there were just a lot of logistical issues that came up in the first week about how to get the right supplies to the right locations to reach the people that needed them most.
Let's turn now and talk about outside of Asheville and in the more rural areas. That itself just sounds daunting because, I mean, there's all these towns that you have no idea what's going on. How do you approach that? Like, what does that look like, organizing an autonomous disaster relief response in a rural area?
Yeah, it looks pretty chaotic from the start, I'd say. You know, once we got enough supplies in to where we felt like we could be sending them out, it was a kind of combination of like doing our own scouting, and then also from social media, we were getting, you know, requests from family members that are outside of the region, you know, hey, can you check on this person or that person? And so that would give us an in to like, oh, we should go check on this neighborhood. And we just show up there with supplies and check on the person, but then also have lots of supplies on hand to give out as needed. You know, we also just like started driving to trailer parks and stuff, you know, places that we just knew were like less resourced. But, you know, we kind of just started with it in our own networks because, you know, a lot of us in our group have family in the area. So starting there and checking on friends and then just kind of gathering intel in those ways. I think we just had a general rule of thumb of like, when we went out on a supply run to like deliver supplies, always like stop and ask people what they need and get get contact information. And then we could like get back to our hub, get those supplies, and then like bring them back out with like more targeted supplies. And, you know, within like, within days, all these little other just community hubs were popping up everywhere, whether that was at like volunteer fire departments or someone's front yard or churches or town squares, like these little hubs just popped up everywhere. So within like 3 or 4 days, it was pretty easy to, drive into a random community and be able to find someone that was kind of self-organizing. And then we'd connect with them and just identify what their needs were. And then we would try to get their needs to them. It was all very organic and kind of unfolded in both chaotic ways, but also started to get more structure to it, I'd say. The real challenge again was also like we'd make contacts with some of these hubs, but they were still, you know, trying to meet the needs of people that you can only get to by foot or four-wheeler, or you had to drive, a four-wheel drive truck through a river to get to. So again, the access was still just very difficult. And there were a lot of private helicopter and plane operators that started showing up and just doing their own volunteer runs. I don't really know as well how that was organized. I know it was crucial in getting supplies back to different communities that were totally cut off.
From your vantage point right now, what are some of the big lessons and takeaways from this?
I'd say, like, definitely better to be overprepared than underprepared. Again, so many of us just underestimated the storm. But, the basics for just going to, like, function and start helping each other in the first 24, 48 hours after a disaster hits. I would say making sure you have a full tank of gas and extra gas on hand, making sure you've got water jugs and your bathtub filled up. But the huge thing is just having multiple alternate forms of communication. And I would really, really stress that people in advance of, if you know a disaster, potential storm or whatever is on its way, to just have a set meeting time in place, already in place in your community where people can know to go to find each other in the event that communications go down. I think that's huge. And I really wish we had had that in place because we could have gotten together much sooner if we had. Satellite communications seem to be very helpful. And unfortunately, a lot of it is happening through Starlink. And we know we can't really rely on Elon Musk to do us a solid there. So I think that's something else that needs to get worked out, is that if we are going to use satellite communication, we need to not be reliant on Starlink.
Yeah, I would definitely echo all of that. I think this experience really, definitely drove home to me the sort of importance of being able to make it through those first 72 hours. So just would echo all of the things that Matt said about preparation for that. With regards to communication and I think how important it is to have, to non-disaster times, working to build, brick and mortar community and infrastructure, people know about and people will gravitate to, when things are so uncertain. I'm really interested in this question of communication, and how important being able to communicate in order to be able to communicate in a crisis, you really have to prepare beforehand. A few days into things, someone showed up to Firestorm to give us a mesh net receiver situation. I'm not a techie. But I was oh, this is really cool. They're attempting to sort of connect West Asheville to downtown to, Swannanoa to, just kind of these sort of immediate areas, to be able to text each other and coordinate. They came in and gave it to us, but it required, an app downloaded on your phone to be able to use it.
Which was absolutely not possible.
Focusing on those, you being able to have what you need for those first 72 hours, in order to, be able to, be, present for these larger community efforts that are happening. But then also really thinking about that communication piece.
And thinking about sort of hardening our own infrastructure for resilience. So for instance, Firestorm has rooftop solar, which is really cool, but there's no battery backup system. So when the grid goes down, there's no electricity at Firestorm, even if there's solar panels on the roof.
Brutal.
So this will be the last major disaster that we experience in which we don't have a battery backup system. Definitely going to figure out how to work that one, because it would have been a real game changer to be able to fire up computers and power electronic tools and devices in those, that first week when we didn't have electricity on the grid.
Firestorm has been in the news the last couple of years over a couple things. And anarchists in Asheville have been a lightning rod for controversy, as they have across the country. I noticed you all posted something on Instagram. It was that feel when the local right-wing troll shows up to the mutual aid event at the anarchist bookstore. I mean, like, what has that been like, you know, in the mix so much in these disaster relief efforts? Has that brought people together in a certain way?
I'm not sure, right, and I'm speaking only for our particular context. I am not sure that I have felt like a major, like, coming together across barriers like that, right? Certainly, like, a lot of people who aren't ordinarily pulled towards sort of, you know, anarchism and organizing and activism in their day-to-day lives, like showing up and being humans with other humans, and like having a desire for community, like that absolutely happened. But on some level, I think sort of the beauty of decentralization is that they were doing, like, we were doing our own thing and other folks were doing their own thing. And we largely have not experienced a lot of stepping on each other's toes or, like, interference or...
Yeah. I definitely an important distinction here between our neighbors who maybe voted for Trump, who it was possible to, like, share resources and have some interesting political conversations in a context that didn't exist previously. I mean, I had a conversation with someone one day who was volunteering here who was very hostile towards the dock workers unions that were going on strike. And we had a whole conversation about, like, whether or not it made sense to be mad at the dock workers for going on strike in the middle of this disaster. And that felt really generative, but that's super different than the organized far right, which has, like, largely engaged with this as an opportunity for disaster tourism, for kind of showing up, getting their photo taken, and then getting on the internet to blame the Jews or to talk about how, like, good working class white people in the mountains aren't receiving any aid from the federal government or whatever ideologically motivated, like, story they want to spin to promote their own agenda. And those are not people that we've obviously not people that we want to be interacting with or building bridges with, or people who honestly we even had an opportunity to do so because they're not trying to connect with us and we're not trying to connect with them.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like from my experience, like, it just feels like politics is just, like, so irrelevant to everyone that's, like, just on the ground trying to get work done right now. It's really just people, like, coming together and, like, making sure, you know, everyone's needs are met, regardless of where they're coming from. So it just feels like politics just aren't even in the conversation for the most part. Aside from, I will definitely say that the anti-immigrant rhetoric is getting pretty strong in some parts where there is very much the bullshit that Trump was spreading and others were spreading about FEMA spending all their money on immigrants, and that's why FEMA doesn't have any money for people in Western North Carolina to recover. That is definitely taking hold in a major way, and is just very, very frustrating dynamic to have to deal with, and is also creating tensions. We've seen it play out at distribution hubs with, like, white folks getting aggravated with, like, immigrants showing up and getting supplies for their families. So definitely, like, yeah, these outsider politicians, like, spreading their bullshit is, like, having really, like, harmful consequences, like, in the communities here. And, you know, yeah, it's just not helpful, and it's just creating divisions where they don't need to be.
You know, I wanted to just broach the question of the far right. I mean, there's been a couple articles written about militia groups. We've all seen posts about white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups, as you said, doing disaster tourism, which, I mean, you know, they usually do this type of stuff. Also, you know, there's famously, like, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, like, these different grifters and politicians pushing, you know, anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant, racist conspiracy theories about everything from, yeah, the federal government doesn't have any money because they used it all on migrants or something, or, you know, the government engineered the storms to hit Trump supporters ahead of the election. How is that all playing out on the ground? I mean, you mentioned one aspect of it. How do we push back against that? How do we incorporate fighting that in our organizing as we deal with this type of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like it's just like total textbook culture war stuff that they're putting out there. And the whole point is to shift the blame off of the government's response and shift it onto, you know, marginalized communities. I mean, the best we can do is just like, you know, talk to people, you know, try to like cut through the lies and tell them what's actually happening. We've also been doing a lot of work with, like, for example, helping to get Spanish interpreters out to different distribution hubs that have a large immigrant population showing up to just help with some of the communication and stuff. And we've actually seen that help to diffuse some of the tensions just by being able to like make two-way communication happen. I don't know. The conspiracy theories are pretty wild. It's just really sad and it's frustrating too, because it's, you know, like they're preying on, like, people are so scared, so hurt, like so traumatized from the storm, and these outside politicians are coming in and just preying on that and just like, you know, just creating bigger divisions and just making it worse, you know, just making it so much worse. Like, yeah, like FEMA's not doing a great job here, but like, but, you know, people can still apply for some sort of meager assistance, but all the crazy conspiracy theories going around is making it so people are scared to even apply for the assistance. And it's not like they're necessarily going to get great help, but they might be able to get some help.
I think the situation we've been in has really been one where getting good information is very difficult. Initially because of a lack of, you know, internet and phone service and things like that. But even after that ended, finding quality information from reliable sources has been tough. Like, and I think that that's really created a very fertile space for disinformation and misinformation to spread. I think in our community, there's a real need to do work around media and information literacy and critical thinking. I think a lot of times we see these conspiracy theories that seem relatively innocuous, or they're at least not like, you know, not like racist or like right wing. But I think not confronting and dealing with misinformation opens the door to the possibility that people begin engaging in a less and less critical way. And become more and more vulnerable to far-right propaganda. But it is truly wild the degree to which getting good information during a disaster is difficult. Even something like whether or not evictions are restarting, you know, we heard that evictions were starting back up in Asheville and attempted to do the legwork to verify that. But even relying exclusively on sort of official channels, including having someone go to the courthouse to ask questions, people talking to folks in the public defender's office, we got contradictory answers for days about what was going on. And I think that's an environment kind of in which it is really easy to slip over into conspiratorial thinking.
And yeah, I want to add, I know there's been some reports of like verified reports of like far-right groups like on the ground doing their photo shoots and stuff. As far as I can tell, some of those reports of like armed militias out, quote unquote, hunting FEMA turned out to not be totally verified. In some cases, like maybe like one person that had threatened a FEMA official. But also don't like, so again, you know, it's hard to get the good information, but I also don't want to like erase or like gloss over the real reasons people here have for distrusting the government. You know, there's a long history of both the government and industries, seizing people's land for extractive industry. It's not like totally out of the blue that people should be scared that FEMA might take their land. Even though that's not the case, there is a history of the government doing that here decades ago. So I think it's important to understand where the fear and distrust is coming from, but also understanding how the far right is kind of capitalizing on that for sure. And also, not making excuses for FEMA. Like, I know another member of ROAR, her great aunt's house was, totally washed away. There's not like one bit left of the house on the land. Even the house, the land's not even there anymore. And she was only offered $15,000 from FEMA. I've got another friend whose parents' house was hit by a landslide and they were denied assistance altogether. So FEMA is not really helping people that much. So we're not trying to make excuses for FEMA, but it's just not helpful to have the far right spreading this bullshit and just spreading fear either.
Yeah, and I would add to that, I think Matt is exactly right that the far right is capitalizing on the behavior of the state. And it also goes the other direction. The state is clearly capitalizing on the far right. And these national narratives about, militias hunting FEMA or whatever really play out in a way that looks a lot like the type of excuse making that we always see with regards to Appalachia, where the people who live here are ultimately blamed for their own, they've created the conditions for their own oppression. And I think a lot of us were worried when we saw, the Washington Post leading with that story about FEMA pulling their agents out of the field, that ultimately what that would serve to do was to create an excuse not to aid people in our region, along the same lines as the sort of why did these people vote against their self-interest? Kind of this idea that the problems in Appalachia aren't related to extractivism, but are somehow the creation of the people who live here themselves.
People listening to this, what advice would you give them to prepare, both in terms of just individual and collective resilience, but also how can we scale up and envision and get mutual aid projects ready for things like this?
Yeah, I mean, I can't stress enough that the ultimate preparation is building community and just doing work in your community before a disaster hits, because it's just so vital to have those relationships built, that trust built, and those networks built in advance. And really the only way you can do that is just putting in the work now. And I really want to stress the relationships and the trust bit too, because I don't know, I just feel like with ROAR, we are able to hit the ground running and do so much because we have incredible trust in each other we as individuals in ROAR can feel empowered to make decisions on the fly and know that our collective members have our backs in that. And that trust also extends to other networks and other organizations in the area. And I'd also really encourage people to not just work in your activist community. ROAR, we've got good connections with our local library system and also people in the public school system and, the local community centers. Do that work and do that work also outside your immediate activist community. I can't stress that enough.
I think that's all exactly right and a great note to end on.
Anything else you all want to talk about?
But also just definitely shout out to Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Network, which is, both doing work and support here in West North Carolina and also simultaneously in Florida. So that's another kind of national level organization that we always encourage people to consider resourcing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then also Podere Emma is doing a lot of great work. If folks want to donate to ROAR, you can go to ruralorganizing.wordpress.com. And we've got donation links up there, and we're trying to really get out a lot of cash assistance to people to help them get back on their feet right now. So any donations sent in are a huge help. No one righteous and no one wrong. Tell me who of us has won. From my head to toes I'm numb. Father sacrificing son. Tell me who of us has won. As this bloody war goes on.
Prince. I am one of the co-hosts of the Dugout podcast. I'm born and raised in Ohio. I use he, him pronouns, and I love talking about why America is fucked up.
And hi, I'm Jordan. I'm also born and raised in Ohio. I use they, them pronouns, and also enjoy talking about the plethora of reasons why America is unsustainable. We got to do something about it.
So tell us a little bit about The Dugout, the show. You all have put out a fair amount of episodes already. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's a project me and Prince sat down and realized that the conversations around black anarchism and the dialogue should be as accessible as anything, especially in a media system. In a media ecosystem like this one. So we've been sitting down, discussing culture, sharpening our critiques, and applying that and putting more sharp, militant black anarchist analysis around media, politics, culture, and our local community.
Yeah, and I'll add that for me it's a really fun project just because I think when you're a black person and you dig into anarchism and you find yourself in a lot of different political spaces, it can be hard to kind of, I don't know, like have space to synthesize your thoughts. And I think when you find other black people that care about militancy, it's fun to have conversations. It's fun to look at different ways of life through kind of the lens of anarchism, especially history. Like, that's something I'm really fascinated in. And I also view The Dugout as, like, us trying to offer into the, like, media and political space something that I think we wished was already out there. And it feels really cool to be developing something in that way. Yeah, it's been fun.
I was listening to one of your first episodes, and you were talking about the political journey one of y'all went on. One of the things I thought was interesting is that one of you all talked about how you used to be in the RCP, I believe, and how you came to anarchism. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, just your own political journey? I don't say that to, like, be, you know, make a joke or anything. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean,
we all start somewhere, right?
Yeah, oh my gosh, it's so funny you brought that up.
That was a lore drop I was not expecting.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, long story short, kinda, when I was in high school in Cleveland, I had a teacher who was a communist, and he was really radical, really direct, really weird, like weird as in, like, we all thought he was a vampire, and he would eat, like, snack on tubes of toothpaste while he was teaching. And he said, he was just a strange man, but he took us through, like, all these revolutionary histories and talking about the communism in China and the Great Leap Forward and just so many different things. He brought in ex-vets or veterans who, like, didn't like their time in the military. He argued with us about abortion, told us we couldn't talk about religion in class. And he was just wild, but he was also a part of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And since I was such, like, a nerd for, like, certain passions and things, like a lot of, I guess, bookish kids are, he invited, like, people from our class to, like, hear, I can't remember what this woman's name was, but she was a big person in the RevCom, and then we passed out newspapers. Like, me and my friends passed out newspapers like two or three Saturdays in a row. And I remember one time we were in the hood on the east side, and I was passing out papers, and this lady who was probably on like having some kind of breakdown tried to snatch the papers out of my hand, and she was like, "You never work for the white man." And then I kind of reconsidered it after that. Yeah.
I mean, me personally, I was doing, like, environmental activism, and I was in, like, my local Sunrise movement. And, like, I still, like, low-key think, like, the aspirations of the Sunrise movement structure is, like, an attempt at, like, a decentralized, like, working model. On, like, the city and, like, locale level, I have no idea what National's about, and what I loved about it was I could just ignore them. But we would do, like, these land acknowledgments, and they would have to be, like, five-minute presentations, and you had to, like, bring history and not just, like, oh, here's whose land we're on, but whose land and some history and, like, ways that folks can, like, materially support here. And I had fallen across, like, some North Shore info and some Klebanali, and I believe it was Reconciliation is Dead by the North Shore info, and then Klebanali's not a piece on harm reduction through Indigenous action. And that kind of got me into anarchism of being like, oh, it's not just, like, white people, or, like, it's not just, like, old people. Like, people are, like, doing things and, like, actively making a culture around this right now. And then that pushed me towards, like, William C. Anderson and Irvin, and then, like, actually getting into more anarchist organizing in my scene, and then joined, like, the harm reduction organization and started doing some direct aid and mutual aid services, and got into zine distroing, and my love for archiving and zines has been from there on.
Yes, I love hearing it. I love hearing about people's radicalization. And I'd say for me, I mean, high school was definitely a period of being radicalized, but college was kind of where, looking back, I realize now that basically I had friends that ran for student government, and so I ran for student government, and then my last year of university was when the Black Lives Matter movement kind of popped off after Michael Brown was killed in fall of 2014. And I look back at it now and I realize, like, some of my friends in student government that I really vibed with, they were anarchists. I just didn't have that language. And then after university, I was, like, studying a lot of, like, civil rights and Black Power movement era, like, history. And I think that's when I kind of started digging into, like, Black militancy or what that could look like. And then I moved to Seattle, had a labor organizing job, got fired, ended up, like, going to Left Bank Books in Seattle a lot. And I remember, I think it's Black Seed Journal was what I started reading. And I was just like, oh, this language is so immersive and emotive. And it's, I don't know, I just really vibed with it in a lot of ways. And from there, I ended up leaving Seattle, talking to my anarchist friends, meeting other anarchists in France that I could, like, crash with. And I started going to, like, May Day stuff there and coming back to the U.S. and those connections kind of grew. And I started kind of reading more stuff, but I think around 2018 was really when I was kind of like, I want to read more literature that's centered around Black anarchism. I wonder what that as a body of thought would be. And I'm not saying that there was no literature or anything out there then, but it felt like it at the time. And I can say in the years since, it has felt like there's been more Black anarchists kind of generating books and anthologies and kind of expressing their ideas online. And so I do think things are shifting in a way that I kind of wish I would have been able to experience or would have known about back then on, like, a media level, especially as, like, someone who's been, like, a freelance journalist too. Like, I just think it's interesting where we show up or where our ideologies are legible.
Yeah, especially when jumping into, like, scenes that are anti-authoritarian, that are anti-capitalist, especially, like, scenes where we feel like we can make direct material impact by doing large-scale mass or, like, more affinity group direct action and really being able to, like, sharpen our critique and our analysis through the community that we've been able to like develop in our region and like in our local communities as well.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting to hear y'all talk about. I mean, as somebody that a couple decades before like got involved through like punk and DIY music scenes and stuff, hearing people talk about coming through sort of other movements or organizations and then like finding stuff online or info shops and stuff like that.
I will say also the DIY and punk scene for me also, that was college and like after college. So it's a part of it too. I agree.
I mean, my experience now is that the people I meet now, it seems like that is less of a factor. And I think that's been, I would say it's positive in the sense that it's bringing more people in. I mean, like, when I was getting involved, it was very, very white because that was sort of the cultural filter that, like, people came through. Not that it was all that, but it seems like now it seems like there's more funnels in which people are sort of finding it, if that makes sense. I don't know. That's my impression. Like, people are kind of finding it through different ways, which is good, which is like bringing in people from a wide range of backgrounds. It seems like more so. That's my impression.
And I think especially with black anarchism, there's like, it's definitely a part of that strand of anarchism that doesn't care what you call yourself necessarily, as long as we can like work together and we can still define principles and move. It's able to, like, you still use, like, I think in the same way that, like, anarchism itself has grown or anti-authoritarian politics has been able to grow, is that more people are able to, like, touch and see and converse around it, especially with the internet.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. I mean, I think it's really interesting to think about how people are coming to it, maybe through different funnels or I don't know, because I think about, like, I mean, I'm 30, and I grew up with a computer in my home, and I grew up, like, seeing social media develop, and now I kind of see, I don't know, like, what could be considered, like, Gen Z and how there's, like, the conversation and I don't know, like, discourses around, like, the loneliness epidemic and people needing third places and just, I mean, experiencing genocides parasocially online, and I wonder both about like all the statistics about how younger people are becoming more radicalized through social media platforms. And that's theoretically why the Trump administration wanted to ban TikTok amongst other things. And it just makes me really think about, and this is also just as, I guess, people that post politically or talk about our politics online, but that's not where all of our political lives are. I just think about the strangeness and the immediacy of developing like a black radicalization online or how, I don't know, there is a lot of opportunity and space to offer variations of what that black anarchism can look like. Because I think those different funnels, like people coming to it through the punk scene, like they might be more into the black bloc stuff. And then it's like, if it's someone who grew up in like an urban city and they experienced gun violence and then like environmental racism, like they might enter it through another space. And so even from that lens, I think there's like a lot of work to be done on a media level to have spaces like with on the internet and outside of it or in media or outside of it for black anarchists to kind of gather and hold space. And like when I think about it that way, I'm like, it makes this work even more necessary because people need their people.
For young people right now that are either online or thinking about what's going on, I mean, they seem to be in this really interesting and like horrific situation right now. I mean, there's this genocide going on in Gaza and they're faced with these two parties, which are both right wing. And I think young people, especially are trying to like wrap their heads around this thing. And also like just coming up to the realization that like, no matter who gets elected, this war is going to continue and things are going to continue to get worse. Cop cities are going to continue to get built. None of the problems that are facing us economically or socially are going to be addressed, and it's just going to be a different flavor of the same system. And I don't know. I think like how we intervene in that and talk about it is really important. But I want to hear your thoughts on sort of the situation that people are faced with, especially younger folks.
Well, I am the Gen Z. I did some youth liberation organizing also when I was considered legally when I was a minor, and I think it does look terrible. And I think like the big thing is that like putting an importance on like maintaining militancy to like define ourselves, define spaces, carve them out, and then hold them and like treat them as something precious and put the energy and love to be able to process the grief of having to maintain such a space in the societies that we're born into that force us to carve this out, and how that sort of like material impact is something that people create online, and there are physical manifestations of that. But I think that's one like countermeasure to it. Cause I mean, it's one of the things that like drove me immediately to like environmentalism, to be like dropping out of college. We're just organizing cause like shit's fucked and we need ways to deal with this now. And it's at this point in my development, it's creating those assemblies and those conversations and those spaces to really like sit down, have a synthesis, find out where we can't, and then be able to find a way to like move forward. And like having our own definitions and having our own like autonomous stances and places, to maintain those sorts of energies.
And I'll also add, I mean, I'll add a few things, but recently we got to interview a former Black Panther Party member, and it was interesting because near the end of the conversation, I was like, oh, what advice would you have to, like, younger people now who are organizing around Palestine and, like, dealing with different ideas about, like, militancy or how you engage with the state or how much you fear the state? And this former Black Panther was just like, I mean, all the issues we were dealing with in my generation is worse now. Police brutality, the environment, like fascism, imperialism. And they were just like, if I could give you advice, I would, but you have your own conditions to deal with. And it wasn't like a throwaway answer, like how some people might think. Like, to me, it really impacted me because I realized, oh, we're constantly breaking new territory. And so I think for younger people, I would say, study history and understand that it can offer us frameworks, but we're also in unprecedented times. I think we have to think about new ways to, like, as Jordan was saying, like, present, like, a militant approach to, like, local and grassroots organizing. And then I think the follow-up to that I've especially been learning this year, like, doing legal defense work for the Boeing 5 and just understanding the different ways that repression in cop cities are going to, like, further repression is anti-repression work is only going to become more necessary. Like, first, I think young people, whether or not you grew up in the neighborhood where the police would beat the shit out of people, like, you have to come to a point where you realize the state is antagonistic towards Black life. And then once you start getting into a militant approach to confronting that, whether it's like mutual aid or Black bloc or whatever, then you have to be prepared to become entangled with the state in one way or another. And that involves like legal defense work, like talking to people on the inside, like, I don't know, having a kind of prefigurative politic, as Martin Sostre would say, towards like a revolutionary life. And so I think it's, to me, it's not just the direct action or when the movement comes up. It's also how do you take care of people emotionally, politically, socially, when the repression and state violence and trauma continues. And when you look at like organizing and having a politicized life through that framework, like, that can be done all the time. It's just not, like, in a movement space. And I think maybe to the point about, like, the internet and social media and how people get to anarchism or Black anarchism, I think that's how especially, like, younger folks can make it real. Like it's a continuous process.
I'm curious, you know, you all have done episodes critiquing sort of the election cycle. You know, what are your thoughts on that as sort of, especially like the Democratic Party sort of revs up its engine to sort of make people excited and, you know, we're the catchphrases, the politics of joy and all this stuff.
I think this goes back to some of the questions before of, like, the history of it. I think, like, the reasons why I crave such material collective space, and as much as we have it online and those institutions, is because, like, being able to have not only radical, but, like, revolutionary history, like, history that is about projects and folks that are redefining what they're putting their political energy into and what political entity or, like, governing structure they want politically or materially. And because, like, the institutions we're fighting, the state, whether governed, whether federally governed by Republicans or Democrats in the executive office, is an institution just like the cops that has such an institutional memory that they remember how to fight these movements from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And I think, I mean, what gives me, like, at least enough, like, ability to be a little not blasé, because, like, a Trump presidency would be terrible. But these are also conditions that have been growing since the beginning of this nation. Project 2025, Unitary Executive Theory, they want what the original republic was supposed to be, which is barely a republic at all. And they want less checks and balances. They want it to be closer to their little, way more sharper, quote-unquote representative of their class republic. And I think that sort of tension in American politics is within the Democratic Party as well, but it just has more plurality, and I think it has that ability to, like, rev up its engines. And I think with more history and more, like, revolutionary history and conversations and spaces that allow us to look at, like, okay, what happens if just Trump wins? What happens if Kamala wins? So that come January, we are not just looking back at, okay, what did we do the past 6 months? Debate liberals? Cool. Fun.
I think so many things about this election. I mean, I think it's helpful for me on an intrinsic level to just define the state as anti-black, and then therefore it's also fascist, because it helps me kind of figure out how to engage, like, socially, politically, and emotionally with the election process. I mean, I think I'll just say that election years are always pure chaos to me. Like, the repression is on the rise. People are yelling at you about why you're not voting and your ancestors fought for you. And I'm like, can everyone just let me not care? And I don't mean, like, not care at all, but I mean, like, be antagonistic towards it. Because I think, one, the fact that it's so confusing for the mainstream that black people are just antagonistic to electoralism as a whole, because we can just look at, like, anti-black violence throughout any era or presidency of the U.S. and beyond, and you can just kind of define the U.S. through that lens, and including, like, anti-indigeneity and including anti-poor sentiments, including xenophobia. And to see that thread again and again, and then to see it weaponized through the identity politics of, like, Kamala Harris, and it's just so sick to me, because, like, from watching the, like, DNC to watching the recent Oprah Winfrey event that she did with Kamala Harris. And then I didn't watch all of the VP debate that was yesterday, but from talking to other black folks, it seemed like, I mean, my one friend earlier was like, why was this debate so seemingly cordial compared to the others? And why could J.D. Vance not, like, really throw any insults at Tim Walz? Is that his name?
Tim Walz.
But he could, like, talk shit about Kamala any moment of the day. And so even in that way, I just see the way whiteness is being deployed. And I don't know. I mean, I think the whole Project 2025 thing, I mean, I made a recent episode about this, but I think for me, I definitely fear Project 2025, but what I fear more is a continued like lack of resistance on like a mainstream level, or like a continued lack of challenging the people that are just like just left enough to say that they're progressive. But I'm like, are you going to be in the streets when denaturalization happens, or are you going to be like talking on a live stream or on your computer at home? Like, I think there needs to be a deeper conversation, kind of to what Jordan was saying about either side of the aisle who wins. What is our continued strategy against empire and imperialism? And how, and I feel like I've been, I don't know, since election years really pissed me off, it's been really helpful to synthesize all these different thoughts around it, because I do think we're given a particular two-party narrative, but the deeper narrative around autonomy, what it feels like to live in this country, what it feels like to be gaslit, what it feels like to parasocially like exist alongside gun violence, genocidal violence, like all of that is very real. And I think that the fact that the mainstream, like the two-party system, doesn't address that at all, like that to me is wild. So that's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, is Harris going to give us reparations? Is Harris going to let Asada come home? Is Walz going to give us land back because he co-governs with an indigenous?
Yeah.
Ojibwe woman?
Will they present a housing plan that doesn't just hand more money to developers and the elite? Like, that would be cool.
Thinking about one of the good things I've seen in this cycle is that there has been this break in some ways with the Democratic Party, at least for a new generation of folks over Palestine. What do y'all think about that and just, like, exposing that split between, like you said, the people that want to fight for autonomy and stay in the streets and continue the struggles that are happening all around us, and the people that are saying, no, go back into the institution, like, shut up, don't protest. Because, I mean, those voices have been very loud, especially on, quote, you know, like, within, like, liberal circles and folks aligned with the DNC. Like, how do we continue to kind of pry that chasm apart?
I mean, it is a reality that this is, I guess, some of the closest the Green Party's ever gotten to actually breaking, like, the duopoly of, like, if they get this, like, 5% or something this term, they can get federal money next term and actually start winning some elections down the line. But everything election-based is, like, as a strategy, is something that is a long-term movement or a long-term endeavor. And on the uncommitted campaign, I mean, like, they have a way to build collectively and have, like, been talking about Arab and American progressive leadership and stuff like that. And as far as I know, like, they're heavily big in Michigan, and I think, like, they have, like, a lot of chance, but I also think, like, a big thing to not forget is that these are folks that are, like, directly, like, they're drawing the line at genocide, and they see that the Democratic Party won't draw the line there at all, and I don't think that, like, necessarily means everything some folks want it to mean. Like, some folks can get a little bombastic in their visions of what this means for a real break and, like, the American mindset around, like, elections or, like, the American project. It definitely shows, I think, like, an increase in, like, progressivism or whatever you want to call it, or more leftist attitudes, like, being unignorable by the state in this condition that we're in right now. And I think that's something interesting to, like, think about, and, like, what kind of language and what kind of policies they're going to try to enact to eventually, like, use folks how they want to. Because eventually they'll take these progressive things and be like, okay, we're going to fully co-opt them so that all the people that are going hard in the street or people that are taking militant action are then cut off from their base as an attempt. And I think it's, like, looking at what kind of organizing that looks like to then still keep that basis with folks.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I mean, I think watching the news cycle and the debates and the different conventions, it's inspiring to see there to be this contingent that is so vehemently anti-war and pro-Palestine, and and I think like anti-war profiting, and I guess I just keep lately I've been thinking a lot about how we're going through a lot of sort of seemingly similar sociopolitical conditions to like the 60s and 70s, like the anti-war sentiments, the racial reckoning sentiments, like definitely like gender and sexuality being on the forefront in terms of like fascism or seeking autonomy or rights, and also like repression being on the rise, and how there are probably new ways of repression that we're seeing, whether it be like RICO charges or homes being swatted or all kinds of things. And I think it's important for there to be an expansion of what is considered acceptable to demand of politicians in the mainstream. And I think if the uncommitted movement is doing that, in terms of Palestine, that's cool, but kind of maybe to what Jordan was also saying, like, I'm interested in what other ways they could push things, like in terms of like really taking seriously abolition. And the fact in 2020, there were all these initiatives and legislations and things to like push for an abolitionary cause, but then that was like funneled into progressivism or just like another form of carcerality. And so I think it's an important moment that this like exists in, and I really want people to push it further and to see how far it can go and like even more disruption, because like people were brutalized at the DNC, journalists were brutalized at the DNC, and like that also existed alongside this narrative of people sort of being a part of, I don't know, the DNC and then sort of being pushed out. And how can these different spaces of like pushing the mainstream and militancy find like a common ground, I think is like probably hopefully an eventual goal for the uncommitted movement, if I could make a suggestion.
Yeah, because I mean, one thing we know, especially as black anarchists, I mean, just because you're a person of color, just because you're an immigrant, just because of your status under the state does not mean you're revolutionary.
Yeah.
It does not mean you're willing to hold space to work towards that.
It doesn't mean you won't call a cop, is what I'll also say. Yeah.
Well, I want to turn now. I mean, you both mentioned you're in Ohio. Obviously, there's been this spotlight on Springfield because of these white supremacist conspiracy theories that have been amplified by billionaires like Elon Musk and Trump. What do y'all think about what's going on?
I hope Springfield, Ohio becomes a black hub of worker co-ops and community councils that overtakes the community. But it really is like mind-numbing. But it's like, it's not at all unexpected. There are like some people in the cities, because like a lot of Ohio is very red. The cities are very blue, and people sometimes forget like, oh, I'm in Ohio. And I used to call it Texas Light, but it's really just Ohio. Like, we're really just like this. And people, like, we had, I think, the third amount of highest hate group militias in 2022, in 2020, that went down after some of them got indicted the past couple of years. We're no longer number three, or we might have been number one, and I think we went down to three. There's been like a lot of attempts to do solidarity work with the community members doing rallies and stuff like that. But I think there's like a general fear that tensions could rise, and folks are just, I don't know, like, taking time to, like, analyze what that means and what that means to be prepared for that.
And to me, it's upsetting. It's upsetting. My parents are from the West Indies, and they immigrated here, and my mother was a part of desegregation busing, like, the tail end. So I think it's fucking disgusting when politicians use people as political ammunition, which politicians do. And it's, I don't know. I mean, it, when I think about it too much, it literally could make me cry, because it's why I started digging more into Project 2025 and trying to understand like at least some of the specifics of how the right wing, view and preach about immigration. And, I've been reading this book called The Brief History of Fascist Lies. And it's honestly been contextualizing a lot about how fascism needs charismatic leaders who have some kind of godlike clairvoyance or sensibility about them, how fascism is not about actual facts or research or even history. It's about like a primordial kind of truth. It's about action and violence. And when I look at what's happening now and how a Facebook post can be turned into this bigger conspiracy theory, and then it can be wielded by a white man on a national stage, and then that leads to literal bomb threats and threats of violence.
Blood Tribe was active.
Yeah.
At city council meetings.
And so to me, it's just history repeating itself. And I guess where I go from sad to angry is I think about, like, it's why I've talked about it online, like all of the people dancing and singing the song and eating the dogs, eating the dog. And to me, it's just, it's so disgusting because I'm like, this violence is very materially in front of you, or maybe not, but to joke about it, to make light of it, to not step in, to not have an opinion on it, I think is just like, it's history repeating itself. People stand by as political violence happens to those who have less than them, those that have more to lose. And it really just makes me, I don't know, I guess just think about like the ways that anti-fascism is like really important, and understanding what groups are passing through your cities or towns, and how I'm glad that work is being done here. And I hope that more people become a part of that kind of work. But it's weird. I'm like, I don't know. It's really disturbing, especially like reading more into the local context and how so many Haitian immigrants were brought in, and how there's this context of like not a lot of resources or help being offered to people, and then this sowing like local divisions and people who like grew up in Springfield like hating on immigrants, and how it just kind of like America has created the context for this to even be possible. And I think that to me is already a problem.
Yeah, like I was listening to NPR the other day, and they were, I don't know if it was in Springfield, or I think it was another town that Trump had mentioned recently, and they were going around talking to all these people, and like 80% of the people they were talking to, they're like, yeah, they like saved the town. They like came in and took all these jobs that no one wanted to work, or like, you know, they needed workers, and now they're a part of the community, and they opened up a shop and or whatever, you know, just basic stuff. And then they like kind of did the both sides thing, and they talked to this one person, and they were like, well, I don't like him because they take too long at the dollar store to like, you know, it's like, really, that's your problem?
Like, this is literally fascist. Like, this is the othering that America does. Like, the only melting pot we have is we have so many different kinds of others that we can have for our fascism. We just do it.
Well, I think the other side of the coin is for, like, the white nationalists that have the ear of Trump, like Laura Loomer and...
I mean, Blood Tribe came to Springfield...
For sure.
The newest iteration of Blood Tribe in Ohio.
And, yeah. The point I want to make, though, is I think that they want to get to the point where they're attacking black people in general. And this is sort of a way to sort of, like, build up to that, because they can sort of pick at Haitian people and, as sort of, like, this other. But they want to sort of, like, build up to a larger thing of saying, like, well, you know, we want to repeal, like, this amendment, you know, roll back birthright citizenship or whatever, because we really want to get rid of all the non-white people. That's the ultimate goal, is to have this white ethno-state.
Yeah, yeah. We have a new N-word every couple of months. It was DEI, now it's Haitians, and...
Yeah, and I totally agree with that, because I think that's what reading more about Project 2025 especially makes me think about, like the combining of ICE and Border Patrol, the lessening of reasons why either institution would need to go into people's homes to check their citizenship, and how, yeah, I mean, that's immediately what I thought of when I saw, like, denaturalization. I'm like, wait, my mom was born here, and then I was born here, so could I not be from here, or could they make that argument? And, I mean, yeah, I think it's such an easy, slippery slope, and I think that's why I think looking at America through the lens of xenophobia, just like as a structural like enmeshment, is so useful, because you can look at almost every era of the US and see how xenophobia and otherization like literally leads to political violence and gives the elite more power. And I think that's what's sick about people making light of it online, is because it's happening outside of your front door. It's happening on your phone. It's happening on the mainstream news. And to not question it and to just view it as a part of our normal system. Like, we have to say that it's not okay and it has been historically sound in terms of the white elite. But I think there's a continuous confrontation with this, because that's immediately what I thought of. I was like, if they're sending my mom home, I'm going to be holding on to that plane on the tarmac. And then they'll probably send me home too, just because, I don't know. And I think it's, yeah, like, and the reality of that to me is not that different than the reality of the U.S. my mother entered in terms of being forced into desegregation busing. And so, like, I just keep thinking, like, history is repeating itself, and we have to be the intervention, like, and by any means necessary.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you mentioned anti-fascism. I think one of the things that's sort of missing right now is like, what we saw during the Trump period, just, like, massive amount of people out in the streets, you know, Richard Spencer getting punched. There's a lot of organizing that's very dispersed and localized right now, but it seems like we are kind of missing, like, the psychological aspect of, like, pushing back and the physical resistance. So looking for ways that people can push back against that and feel powerful and come together and express solidarity instead of sort of, like, the SNL level liberalism of making some, like, weird video about laughing at Trump saying they're eating the dogs or something. Like,
yeah,
that's what it is for a lot of people. I mean, one thing that I think when looking at, like, the current anti-fascist scene is, like, folks are addressing, or I think, like, some folks are thinking, like, really, what does it mean to do more than to just, like, go out and punch Richard Spencer? What does it mean to be organized and have some sort of unity? Especially when wielding any sort of political violence, especially one that is authoritarian and recognizes like the direct need, and also the direct need to be sustainable in that. Like, I think there's, like, a resurgence kind of more, like, more localized, but definitely a resurgence of community defense clubs. And, like, attempts at that. And I think a lot of those aren't very public and not very seen, and they're more in the background, figuring out how to develop a real way to have, like, a sustained material impact and stay in community with the folks that they want to and need to sustain their own livelihood. And that can look like just folks getting together once a week to practice some martial arts, to condition or, like, exercise together, to meal prep, like, get together, cook a meal for, like, three people, for, like, a week. So everyone has, like, a frozen meal together and, like, talking about, these things in a way that, is, like, productive individually and collectively, and really finding and sparking that balance. And I think that's also one way to bring in, like, a prefigurative politic into how we organize around the certain modes of violence around us and how we need to react, not only in kind, but in building our own safe havens.
Yeah, I think the community defense element is really important for people to really practice on a local level. And even though locally I haven't shown up to any of the meetings in, like, 3 months, that's another conversation. but I think engaging in that,
but that's okay. It's just an exercise group. We're just chilling, you know? Like, that's fine. Yeah. Like, we in and out. It's community.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not – I feel that. But, I think, like, engaging in these things, talking about it with you and your friends, talking about what self-defense looks like, collective community self-defense looks like, I think that's the stuff you do in between these periods of upheaval or these periods of – whatever the mainstream considers to be overt fascism. And that is what gives me hope, because I can call my mom and I'll be like, did you watch the DNC? I can't believe they said that. She's like, woo, Jamaican is going to be president. I'm like, oh, Lord, we got work to do. And I think the work is me trying to operate in a militant way and then to engage socially, politically, personally with people about that, having those conversations. I think with family especially, like, that's where it kind of starts for a lot of people, like, being real and letting people know that there are people in their space or their community that are going to challenge these things and opening up that discourse, because I feel like in, when did Trump become president? In 2016, when Trump became president, like, I felt like I knew a lot of white people, especially, that were, like, scared shitless into, like, silence for, like, a week or two or however long, and then they jumped into organizing. And I think people have become radicalized more since, but the connectedness of that anti-fascist work, the connectedness of that community defense work, I think is what especially more white people need to do in order to show up for people that are going to be on the line who maybe aren't them. And that's what I hope for if any kind of denaturalization is happening, because they might have me in the paddy wagon day three, and who's going to bust me out of the thingy thing? Somebody help. And so I think that's what I hope.
Take a whole new meeting.
Yeah. So that's what I hope communities and collectives and people out there start thinking about. It's not like only showing up to the actions. It's like actually preparing your body and mind on a day-by-day regular kind of basis. Like, have study groups, share meals, have those conversations, and do that behind-the-scenes work.
I really thank y'all for taking the time to talk. I hope everybody checks out The Dugout. It is linked in our show notes. Do y'all want to talk about anything you have coming up on the show? Any surprises? You want to tease out anything?
We do have a few cool episodes in the docket. We have a few episodes coming out around mid-October. October 15th, I believe, is when the Black Panther Party was founded. So we'll be coming out with a Fred Hampton episode, and then releasing an episode with an interview with a former Black Panther Party member. And then down the line, because it's
Jenina Irving?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also down the line, we have another episode kind of contextualizing the struggle for Black voting and how that can hopefully go towards, like, a fuller Black autonomy. But yeah, those are some of the things we have.
Yeah, and then also just a quick shout out for some other projects we work on. In the Belly, which is an incarcerated magazine by incarcerated abolitionists for incarcerated abolitionists, made by formerly and currently incarcerated folks. And then In the Mix, which is a project of the same audience and producers. And then also just like for like the, around the conversation of Project 2025, like a lot of America, like we really only talk about what it does to us, like here in America and like internationally too. Like a lot of anarchists like don't want to talk about what the state does, or just not interact with it. But like when we talk about how it's really, really like fascistic too, is like it's imperialism, and like Project 2025 stances on Turkey, like is just completely disregarding, and like fucking over all of our Kurdish homies. And comrades, so wanted to shout that out, and also just like if folks are like really like talking about like what will Project 2025 look like and like how it's gonna be starting, whether or not he's in the presidency or not, those are the things that folks could be looking at. But yeah, stay up to date on The Dugout. More to come.
Well, let's transition now and let's talk about the U.S. election.
Nice.
So, you know, we've talked at length about this off air about the U.S. election. You're in the opinion that Harris is going to win. I'm more pessimistic. The polls have been pretty set for a while. It seems in the aggregate, Harris is like maybe 1 or 2 points ahead, or they're tied. Why don't you lay out your quickly pitch that you think Harris is going to win?
There's a number of variables going on here. One of which is that polling, presidential polling, isn't reflecting the same outcome as all of the other political variables that we can look at, including non-presidential polling. So if we look at, you know, campaign on-the-ground organizations, the Trump campaign outsourced all of that to, at this point, a PAC run by Elon Musk, who, according to a recent study that literally just got put out yesterday, 25 to 30% of their reported door knocks are just canvassers saying they knocked on people's doors that they never knocked on. So they really have no idea how many people they've talked to. None. They have no concept of what polling looks like. They're almost out of money. They're not raising money. And they're pulling all of their advertising back and focusing on hiring attorneys, right? Trump is dropping out of events. He's dropping out of podcast interviews. He's falling asleep at rallies. Like, that is not a campaign that is doing well. When you look at other polling, say around the governor's race in North Carolina with Mark Robinson, the quote black Nazi, he's been getting trounced and it's been dragging the entire ticket down, except somehow Trump, right? Which doesn't make any sense, especially when you consider demographic shifts in North Carolina and what that generally means with traditional American voting behavior as far as age and race and class and education level. You see the same dynamic in Arizona. You see a similar dynamic in Nevada, right? And so when you look at the presidential polls, one of the things you see is they are all over the place. There's almost no consistency about them at all. What we're watching in this 1% to 2% is sort of the aggregate of polling. That's what people are relying on now, partially because individual polls mean essentially nothing right now. So what are people really responding to? Okay, what they're responding to are a number of dynamics which have changed since the DNC. One is the Harris campaign no longer is just running on pure vibes and energy, right? So they're less loud now, right? The second thing is the Trump campaign has gotten louder. Much louder. They've also gotten a lot crazier, and they've lost support in most polling when it comes to polling people about the individual things he says and the individual policies he has. He has lost support, and that has been a consistent trend ever since he walked down the escalator, right? So we're not watching a big shift in American politics. We're watching a campaign get louder in desperation to try and seize a media cycle, right? But if we look at these dynamics in the presidential polling, they actually mirror very similar dynamics to what we saw during the last election, right? Where Biden and Trump are running almost even, and that is definitely not how that ended, right? And so there are a lot of running theories about why presidential polling doesn't necessarily reflect anything accurate about the American electorate today, some of which being about how polls are done, namely they call people and people don't answer calls from numbers they don't know, especially if we're younger. So polls tend to skew older. Polls are based on party affiliation designations, which in the U.S. are a really weak identifier of someone's politics, right? But also polls are based on this idea that American politics is mass politics. And that used to be true. But what we're seeing now is a very different dynamic. The American electorate's been more or less locked in for a relatively long time. And so this entire election is about like 2% of the voting population in like 5 to 7 states. That's it. You know, everyone on the left is talking about like, oh, the Democrats are moving away from the working class. They should be talking to the working class. And there's two assumptions there that are very wrong. One is that people are assuming the working class is progressive. And that's very rarely been true in American history. The working class has a very long history of being party to racial conflicts around labor and labor availability and things like this. And yes, those have been perpetuated by bosses and the right wing, but that does not mean that working people are not participating in them, right? And that is deeply a history in the United States, just as much as unionization and cross-racial solidarity and things like this. And we have to remember that, right? But the second thing is the quote working class is irrelevant in this election. What is relevant is quote moderates, so people who haven't decided who they're going to vote for, people in sort of suburban areas that surround major cities that sometimes vote conservative and sometimes vote liberal, right? And you kind of see that flip-flop in the last number of elections. They have gotten significantly more liberal, right? They voted Democrat a lot more frequently. And you see these elections being decided by turnout. And so right now, early voter turnout is massively high. And historically, that favors Democrats. And so when you take all of that in aggregate and you start to look at the election from that lens, it's a different picture than what you see from presidential polling. That doesn't mean Harris is going to win. No. Does it mean Harris probably has a much better chance of winning than the presidential polls indicate? Yeah, and that's actually what a lot of political scientists are saying as well. And so we put a lot of stock in polls because they're easy to write headlines about. And because they're easy to write headlines about, journalists can hit their deadlines. But polls individually mean nothing. And what means a lot more now are the political dynamics of a very small sliver of the electorate. And those political dynamics have been shifting in the Democrats' direction for like the last 8 years, right? And that's not in the places that matter, North Carolina, Georgia, Wisconsin, places like this. And they haven't been moving the other direction, right? In all of those states, Republicans have been losing power for a while and have been trying to gerrymander their way back into it, right? Like this, it's not an electoral landscape or terrain which favors them at all. And the fact that the campaign is so disorganized means that they're rolling into this election pretty much based on assuming that people that love Trump will vote for him and show up. But what they're doing is they're campaigning in states like California and New York, which are not in play. And that, again, demonstrates a campaign that is only willing to campaign in front of friendly audiences in places where it thinks it's not going to face a lot of resistance. So it campaigns in conservative areas of New York State or conservative areas of California. But that doesn't really have much of a strategy. And that's reinforced by the idea that they're just hiring a lot of lawyers now and prepping lawsuits already, which, sure, again, doesn't tend to indicate that they're planning on winning this thing.
I don't know if I disagree with your ending analysis. I guess I would just push back and say that I feel like, and again, this is just, you know, kind of my own personal reflection, it feels like there is a little bit more wind in the sails of Trump just in terms of the fact that Biden is in office. So Harris is kind of coming from a position of, you know, I'm not necessarily the change candidate. I'm here. I mean, she is in the sense that Biden has been removed and that there's this sort of energy just in the sense that, like, people are excited about something different. But, I mean, she is the vice president. So there is also this kind of feeling that, like, this is the ruling order kind of, like, continuing. I'm looking at an article in Vox. It's three theories on why Donald Trump's popularity is rising. They're talking about essentially just his approval ratings among young people and voters of color, you know, going down around January 6th and then sort of bouncing back. I think a lot of this bouncing back up until, like, you know, the election now, I think a lot of this is around the idea that some people think that Trump is going to do something about the rising cost of living, rent, and just food and stuff like that. I mean, the election itself has been built sort of around these economic concerns, and there's a feeling with some people, and I mean, I don't agree with this. I mean, I also don't agree that the Democrats are, you know, are our friends and going to produce policies that are going to make people's lives better. I think that comes from us organizing and fighting back against capitalist interests. But, I mean, there is this perception among some people that Republicans make the economy good and that that means more jobs and that means more money in our pockets, or that prices go down. And, you know, I see signs all the time from people I live around saying, like, if you want lower prices, vote for Republicans. And a lot of people believe that.
But is it a lot of people, right? So what we really see when Americans are asked about things like price controls or, you know, federal health care or things like that, is that very consistently Americans hate neoliberalism, right? Like, that is – it's not a popular position.
Right, but I mean, that's how Trump has based his whole campaign around.
It gets sold as a campaign around against tyranny, right? Like, that's how they talk about deregulation. But one of the things that you've seen with Trump this entire time is as he specifies things, he loses support. And we're watching a similar dynamic play out now. Like, there was this moment in time where people were freaking out that Trump was going to get like 20% of the black vote or something. It's not going to be anywhere near that. It's just not. That's a really spectacular headline. But if you look at the last election, that was also a fear. If you look at 2016, also a fear. And that never actually happened. Not once. Because at the end of the day, when it really comes down to it, people do remember things. There is such a thing as political history, and people do read and they research. And Trump can convince someone for a brief period of time, but what we've watched is his support tempers off as time goes on. And so he'll get these little spikes, but they always peel back. Trump is a person who revolves around having interesting content, right? What is the interesting content now? So, like, let's go back over the last week, okay? The week started with Trump tripling down on racist conspiracy theories about people eating pets, then canceled a bunch of podcast interviews, then danced on a stage for 38 minutes in the middle of a town hall because he said it was, quote, dance time, then fell asleep at a rally. The numbers around people that are concerned about Trump's ability to just be the president at all have crested over 50%. So again, once you start to take numbers like that, or say 60% of the American population has said they will never vote for the guy, just mathematically, all of a sudden he's got a problem. What we've never seen in the entire time Trump has been a political figure in the United States and presidential politics in the recent period. I'm not talking about the weird time you ran for the reform candidacy in, like, I think 2000 or something. I'm talking about the recent period. So since he came down the escalator, what we have seen is Trump peak out support during that campaign and trail it off ever since. There's never actually been a point where outside of volume, he has quantitatively gained significant support at any point. Even after he almost got assassinated, which is the first time in American history someone's popularity has not shot through the roof after an assassination attempt. That should tell people a lot, right? And it's indications like that. So, like, yes, again, is it a spectacular headline for Vox to talk about how some people think that Trump is good for the economy? Yes, and that happens in every election. Someone always writes that article about how people are, quote, voting against their interests or something like that. This is like a constant line from progressives all the time. Like, I've been hearing it where I live my entire life, literally my entire life, is how Democrats hold on to power is they talk about how you shouldn't vote against your own interests, right? Like, this is the constant. That's not any different than any other election. This is a story in every election. Right. And again, what I want people to really focus on is the fact that this election is really about 2% of the voting population, like seven states tops. Right. It's not about you. Nobody cares about you if you live in a state that's already decided. It literally your existence is literally irrelevant. It doesn't matter. I live in a state that's very likely already decided, and it's pretty irrelevant how many of us show up, to be perfectly honest. Right? We already know what the outcome is going to be. So really, it's not about us. Nobody's talking about where I live. Nobody cares. We did have candidates come recently for the first time. And I live in a city that used to be a bastion of Democratic presidential politics. We finally had candidates come for the first time, like last week. Right? That's how much they care about the states they think are already decided. Right? If you live in one of those places, this has nothing to do with you, right? And so if you feel like these people aren't talking to you, you're right, they're not. Like, they don't care about you. They don't care about you to begin with. But, you know, it explains a lot about how the Democrats are sort of falling into this kind of political incoherence around things like border politics and stuff like that. Is it that the Democrats are like secret conservatives who have been lying to us for all these years? No. Is it that their politics have changed? No. It's that they've never had any. that this is about cynicism. They're taking on positions which are different than the positions that they had articulated before because they think it's going to appeal to that 2%. That's what this is about. It's pandering-based politics, right? That's all. That's all it is.
And I think as anarchists, we shouldn't forget that both parties are largely despised and that a lot of, you know, there's a deep cynicism about this election. I mean, literally we went into this, it's the same people, it's the same two options that were up for grabs last time, which were people were not excited about. If anything, I think the biggest force out there is people that are just either not excited about the election at all and just kind of disgusted by the whole thing. Yes. And also, you know, most people that are going to pull the lever for Harris are doing so not because they like Harris, but because they just don't like Trump.
Yeah, they tried to construct this situation where Harris would have a political mandate, right? Like we talked about this when Biden got elected. Biden came to office and tried to do a bunch of stuff right away and got a lot of pushback. And it was because he misunderstood the situation. Like he came in thinking he had a mandate to like do anything and he didn't. Right. He was just not Donald Trump. That was the only reason he was there. And with Harris, it's going to be very similar. And so what that means, though, is that for us, we have to prepare regardless of what's coming. Right. We've watched already repression ramp up under Biden. Right. Like what they're doing to us now, what they're trying to do to the anarchist movement today. Is far more coherent and organized than it ever was under Trump. And that was also true with Obama. Like some of the worst repression I ever experienced in my time doing this was under Obama, right? It wasn't Bush. It was under Obama, right? The reality is that Democrats are the ones that are engaged in campaigns to use police in cities to crush protesters. They're the ones that are trying to build cop cities, right? Like this is not just a Republican problem. And so regardless of who wins, we have to be prepared to stand in the way of stuff, right? Like the reality is that the first Trump term was largely ineffective. It was chaos. It was exhausting. I think some of us, including myself, are still tired from that period. But we were able to stand in the way of a lot of things at high cost, right? There's a lot of people in prison from the uprising. There's a lot of people that got deported, right? There's a lot of people that experienced political violence, but we did largely push back a lot of what they tried to do. And then it felt like people got complacent when Biden got into office, and we have to make sure that does not happen this time. Regardless of who wins, right? From day one, we got to be out there. We have to be organizing. We have to be doing, like where I live, a lot of the conversation is about local autonomy, right? Everyone's sick of both political parties. So kind of regardless of who wins, how do we get more power in our lives, right? That's a relevant question. And that's a question we can organize around. And so as we're going into this, you know, start to think about what infrastructure you're building where you live. Are you, you know, in a position, rested, ready to be able to respond to something if something happens, right? I mean, say, for example, Harris does win this election. The fallout from that politically is going to be pretty intense, probably. And it's going to last months. And we're going to have to get ready for that, right? Like, we saw it in 2020. We lived it, a lot of us. And looking back on that period of time now in the rearview mirror by 4 years, like that was a deeply intense period of time. And we are likely to see, probably not to the same degree, but we are likely to see similar dynamics emerge again if Harris were to win, right? And that is like the least chaotic scenario. Okay, so like that's what we're looking at in a couple of weeks, just to give everyone a bit of a reality check of how close we are to this.
Is it fair to say that we both agree that the election will be close and that Trump in some capacity will attempt to contest the election and say that it was stolen if he...
I think that that is a certainty, is that Trump is going to say he won regardless of the outcome.
Talk about the scenario that you see playing out. What do you see happening? How would he say that it was stolen, and what would that mean?
I mean, how did he say it last time? He just said it was, right? Like,
he was the president, now he's not.
But we have to take what he says seriously, right? So what has he been doing for the last 3 months already? Talking about how mail-in ballots are going to be stolen by the Democrats and the voting machines. And, you know, he doesn't know how it's going to happen, but if he loses, he knows it's because it got stolen. You know, like, this is all preparatory. You know, he might be a very weird guy, and he might have some deeply messed up understandings of life, but he is not an idiot. Right? Like, he does know what he's doing. He's not passive here. And so when he's saying these things, he does mean them. And he's already preparing his supporters for the idea that the election's going to be stolen. Polling has already been done about this. And I forget what the exact number was, but it was over 50% of Republicans said that if Trump loses, it will only be because there was cheating. The election hasn't even happened yet. We're already there. Like, we're already in the world where the election's been stolen and it hasn't even happened yet. So that's how he's going to do it. He's already done it. Like, he's already prepared that ground. You know, like, I think for those of us that live in places like where I live, where there's not a lot of conservatives, it is really important for us to pay attention to what they're saying, because we don't see it all the time, right? It's not all up in our face all the time. But it's there, and it's real, and it has real impacts on our lives, and we have to pay attention to it. We can't just pretend that they don't exist because we don't see them, right? We need to have essentially political object permanence, right? Like, we need to be able to go, oh, this thing we don't see is still a thing that exists, and these are the dynamics that are happening. And right now, those dynamics are already leading to a narrative that the election has been stolen, and it hasn't even occurred. So we're already there. It's not a question of how he's going to do it. He's already done it.
You know, when we wake up on November 3rd or whatever, I mean, what do you, in the broad strokes, what do you expect to see?
We're not going to know. I don't think we're going to know. Just like in 2020, there's a lot of people voting early. There's a lot of mail-in voting. So what happens when that happens? Okay. So again, like, let's, from the perspective of a person with a poli-sci degree, like, the history of what that means for a vote count, traditionally in America, is that rural voters and conservative voters tend to go on election day. This is like a tradition in a lot of communities. It's a thing that has played out in American politics for a very long time. Conservatives tend to go on election day. As mail-in voting has become a lot more common, as early voting has become a lot more common, the tendency has been for that to be concentrated in places with higher concentrations of people, and those tend to be cities and those tend to be Democrat areas, right? So on election day, because people use electronic voting machines now, largely in most places, we have what is referred to as a provisional count. So it's not a final count. Right. So like what they talk about on election night is never a final count. Right. We learned that in 2000 with Florida, which was called for Gore, then called for Bush, then called for Gore, then called for Bush, then thrown up in the air. Right. Like, and that was based on what the provisional vote totals were. And they kept flipping back and forth. Those vote totals are not certain. They have to do an official actual count. Right. So what those are the results that come back from the tabulation machines, essentially. Just kind of added up. That's it. But you still have to count mail-in ballots. You still have to count absentee ballots. You still have to count ballots that get sent in from citizens that live overseas, people in the military, people who, you know, get extensions on turning their ballots in, which for various reasons, like you're in the hospital or something, you can do. You know, there's a few days to a week in there where there's still ballots coming in. Now, most of the time, that doesn't matter. There are not enough of them to really change anything. But in an election like this, it actually very much does. And what we saw in 2020, and what Trump is getting criminally charged for now in the federal election indictment, is that he knew he lost and said he won anyways, right? That he was being told by people he lost that he was going to lose. That even though it was showing that he was winning on election night, just the sheer numbers alone were showing that he was not winning by enough to actually be able to carry all those other ballots getting counted. And they were right. All the people telling him that were right. He also knew that they were right. And he also knew what that meant. And so he declared himself the winner on the night of the election when it showed him winning. But the reality is that votes were still getting counted for days after that. And those actually mattered in the sense that they swung states. And that's also going to be true this time, right? Like, we're not going to know on election night, probably, unless the polling is, like, so radically off that it's just missing something completely, right? We're not likely to know on election night. And that's, in some ways, kind of the worst outcome, because that creates the possibility, that uncertainty that allows conspiracies to exist. And that's very likely what we're going to see happen again. I don't have any doubts about it. I don't have any doubts about it. I mean, and when I mean close, I mean in Trump world, that's like within 10 percentage points, right? Mm-hmm. Like not actually close in presidential politics, but close in any sort of realm of believable election, any result would be close in that world.
So right? What avenues can we expect them to pull? I mean, beyond like the classic spreading conspiracy theories and...
Well, so they're already lining up court cases. Right, they're training a bunch of quote election watchers, like the RNC is training all these people, to file reports not with the Federal Election Commission or with state election commissions, because you actually have to have proof for that, but with their lawyers. So they have a bunch of lawyers that are going to be answering phones, just like the last election, but they're really organizing it this time. Right, that tells me they're prepping for lawsuits. Like they've already shifted their advertising money out of every single state pretty much except Pennsylvania and Georgia, like almost entirely, not completely, but almost completely. And all that money has been put into legal fees. Right. Again, that's not a campaign that looks confident it's going to win. That's a campaign that looks confident that's going to try to claim it won. Right. You wouldn't be preparing that way if you were actually trying to contest certain states. You'd be preparing that way if you were confident that you were going to lose those states by narrow margins and were then going to try and challenge the results in the courts. Like, that's their entire posture right now. So I think that's very instructive for us, right? Like, we need to see what they're doing. We need to see how they're preparing and how they're shifting their own campaign strategy, because that's going to tell us a lot of what they're going to do. And I don't think they're hiding it.